The opening of the United Nations is always a time to reflect on a worldwide peanut gallery, a time to reflect upon the great hopes that started this organization in the late 1940s when some 56 nations, transparent mostly, democracies mostly, made up this organization to the point where it's reached today of 192 countries, and of those 192, over 130 are tyrannies, and they're setting a world agenda. That should make us all angry. The hypocrisy, the mendacity can be overwhelming, particularly when you've watched the proceedings as I did today for a number of hours. We're going to be examining the issues that this session of the General Assembly is going to be looking at over the next two nights. We're going to be looking at Darfur. We're going to be looking at the UN's hypocrisy on Darfur and some of our own Canadian hypocrisy on Darfur. We're going to be looking at the question of Iran, obviously, the great confrontation. We're going to see what Ahmadinejad is planning, what he's going to say, how he's going to say it. Not that the nuances really matter. Take him at his word. And Baevsky of the Hudson Institute will be joining us tomorrow night. Louis McKenzie will be with us later tonight, as well as Deepak Opre, the parliamentary secretary to the foreign minister. But overriding this session of the General Assembly is going to be the question of militant Islam. Whatever the issue is, you've got militant Islam in there. This organization that was founded on the belief that reason and dialogue can bring people together has today at its throat and operating under the pressure of reactionary forces. And when I say reactionary forces, I'm choosing my words carefully. I hearken back to the words of Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's chief, started the war in the Middle East with Israel, and then made an extraordinary statement, said, well, I wouldn't have started the war if I knew what Israel's reaction would have been, implying that kidnapping is a perfectly normal diplomatic tool. The political correctness that has seeped into our culture, into the media, is no longer acceptable for a free people. And it reached its apex this past week when a pope cannot make a historical reference to a conversation without much of the Islamic world taking to the streets, attacking churches in Nablus and Ramallah, burning effigies of the pope in Pakistan, when much of the Islamic street thinks that violence is the appropriate reaction, the world's got a big problem. And I'm glad to welcome our first guest who gives us straight talk on this problem. Father Raymond D'Souza is a columnist with the National Post. He's a man very involved in community, in ecumenical work. And in an article he wrote, his first line is what we need to bear in mind. That the eruption of rage in some quarters of the Islamic world against Pope Benedict XVI requires several tough things to be said. And we're going to say some of those tough things. You know, every one of the three monotheistic faiths had violence in it. You take a look at the Old Testament, the conquering of the land, conquering of the seven kingdoms, there was violence. The interpretation of the violence, the rejection of the violence by Jewish scholars is what is important. The Christian message, frankly, had no violence. The message of Jesus was a gospel of love and peace. Later leaders of the church, through the Crusades, used violence. Christian theologians then rejected violence. Pope Benedict was stating a historical fact about the beginnings of Islam, and not even in his own words, but repeating a conversation. How is it that we tolerate actions in the Islamic world that we would not tolerate anywhere else with the politically correct notion of, quote, developing cultures, unquote, or, quote, failed states, unquote, right to be wrong? Father Raymond D'Souza, welcome, and tell me if I'm wrong on what I just said.
Well, thank you for the invitation to join your program. There is, I think, just to take up your last point, a question about whether we have a bigotry of low expectations, is a popular phrase used, meaning that when we see these kinds of really quite over-the-top reactions in the Islamic world, that we don't, as you say, treat them seriously and say this is an unacceptable way to have a disagreement. And there's almost an implication there that we don't expect better, or we don't think that they're capable of better, which is not a correct position, and in fact, I think encourages that kind of behavior in the future. So I think there is a, as you say, that there's a double standard, but the double standard is at least implied. It's a negative judgment on the Islamic world, and there's no reason why. The Islamic world has a very long history of learning and scholarship that they cannot respond, in this case, to Pope Benedict's scholarly speech in a scholarly way.
Father D'Souza, I'm sorry to interrupt. I think I may have gone a little long with the introduction. I'm being waved. We need to take a short break here. We'll be right back with you. Montreal, we're back, and we're talking to Father Raymond D'Souza on the Arab Street's reaction to Pope Benedict's quotation of a 14th century work. And Father D'Souza, you were saying before the break that the Islamic reaction is actually a knock on Muslims. That the Muslim culture does have a history of critical thought, and the current reaction of rage in the streets does that a disservice.
Well, I wrote on Saturday in the Post that that most Muslims, I think, or how can I measure, but I would think many are very embarrassed by this. The kind of burning in effigy, the kind of course, worst of all, the actual violence against Christian churches. Disagreements are going to happen. Disagreements may even be pointed, but there's no excuse for this. And the first thing that needs to be said is that this is not provoked by anything the Pope said. I mean, nothing the Pope said could provoke a kind of rampage like this. And it's the first embarrassment is on the Muslim side, and I don't doubt that that many Muslims, I would think probably the majority, find this a unpleasant face of Islam. And the tragedy is it's not necessary because, as I mentioned, there is a long history of scholarship and learning in Islam, and there's no reason why that can't be drawn upon if there is to be a disagreement, a dispute.
You know, the overreaction to the Pope's comments reminded me of another work from the Middle Ages, which I'm sure you're acquainted with, called the Khuzari. And this was a series of letters from the king of the Khazars, which was a kingdom in what is today Russia, to a rabbi in Spain, because this king was being pressured to convert his kingdom to either Christianity or Islam. And to avoid either geopolitical pressure, he started a series of correspondence with his rabbi in Spain, and the history tells us that he converted his court to Judaism as a sort of middle ground. Now, it would be almost as if somebody would quote from that book, and then Muslims and Christians would be upset at somebody quoting from a book of correspondence that was a historical fact.
Well, I don't think that the reaction on the street and was in direct response to what Pope Benedict's address was about. Very few would have read it. I think it was portrayed in the Arabic language media sometimes incorrectly that he wasn't quoting that he was saying. But regardless of those confusions, you have to ask hard questions of the leaders who incited this sort of thing about what their purposes are. Because is it because they feel offended? There were several clarifications about what the true meaning of the text was. Or is it that they were trying to make some other point, either to show some kind of strength or intimidation and so forth? And especially when you get to the extreme of physical violence, you have to ask what is at the root of this, because it's incomprehensible that it could be a disagreement or a historical disagreement on historical analysis.
I believe as you believe that most Muslims reject this kind of outrageous reaction. But where is that outrage on the part of moderate Islam? As you pointed out in your article, when Pope John Paul II made his trip to the Holy Land, he was jostled on the Temple Mount, he was shouted at, Bashar Assad, the Syrian president, went into an anti-Semitic rant. Where is the moderate Arab street? Why aren't we hearing from them on anything?
Well,
we keep saying it as if it's a mantra in the West that we know that most Muslims are. fine. We know most secular Muslims are, but the implication is that most religious Muslims are moderate. Well, fine, but where?
There are 2 points I'd make on that. One is that the first victims of the kind of Islamist extremism we're talking about are Muslims. They're the ones who die in the largest numbers in these disputes. We see that in many places, especially in Iraq, where tens of thousands have been killed in Muslim-on-Muslim violence. So they're the first victims. And so there is a real question of intimidation that, if you could imagine, this is what happens when the Pope in Rome, or in Germany in this case, says something. Imagine if you're not a high-profile local Muslim leader in Pakistan or in Iran or Saudi Arabia or Egypt, and you wish to make a critical comment about these excesses, it's quite understandable that you might think twice if this is what's happening to Christians who are famous, who are well-known. Imagine what could happen in your own backyard. And so that is a very real question of intimidation. And it has to be noted that, as I said in my article, and I've written many times, the principal victims of Islamist extremism are fellow Muslims. They're the ones who die first and in the largest numbers. So this is a problem that, at the moment, that we Catholics are feeling particularly sensitive about, this sort of the ferocity of this Islamist reaction. But we have to remember that the ones who bear it on a daily basis and the ones who have the greatest incentive and need to solve this problem over time are Muslims themselves, because that's where the damage and that's where the violence is principally done.
Last question, Father D'Souza, and you anticipated it in what you just said. If time is the issue, and if the Jewish faith overcame the violence that was inherent historically in the development of a nation, and the Christian faith overcame the violence of everything from the Crusades to the Inquisition, are we saying that the 1400-year development of Islam is not yet finished and we have to wait through that era? That the modern era will not impact, there won't be a critical mass of time, and that all the world can do is wait?
No, I wouldn't say that it's a matter of waiting for centuries, because in Islamic history already you find periods of great peace and stability and learning and culture. Hundreds of years ago you find this. This sort of branch of Islamist violence and extremism is a relatively recent phenomenon. One might say 20, 30, 40 years, so it's a recent development. It's a perversion of Islam that is very powerful and lethal. But it's not a question that this has been how Islam has been for 1,400 years, uninterruptedly, and therefore we have to wait, you know, several centuries, because Islam wasn't like this. This wasn't a problem all the way through. And in fact, there are periods of great Islamic peace and prosperity, and we have to find the resources. When I say we, actually, it's principally a task for Islam itself, to find the resources to bring that to the fore again. All that Christians can do, and what Benedict, I think, was principally trying to do, was to put this issue on the table with some urgency, and as it turned out, it's an issue that has got probably more attention than he thought it would get, and in ways that he wished it wouldn't, but there it is.
Father Raymond D'Souza, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for the invitation. Have a good evening.
Take care. We'll Bye-bye. Be right back. Montreal, with the opening of the United Nations, we're going to be looking tonight and tomorrow night at the issues on the international agenda that very, very much affect us, that are going to affect the deliberations of the UN. And we're going to be looking at everything from radical Islam, as we just did with Father Raymond D'Souza, through Afghanistan, Darfur, Iraq, and the threat of Iran. Right now, let's go to Reza. Reza, good evening. Reza? 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 I think we lost Reza. Nick, we got Reza? Reza? Okay, Peter. Peter? The technical gremlin.
Hello.
Yes, Peter.
Yes, hi, how are you?
How are you?
Good. You had a gentleman on this morning. I believe it was from the Canadian Muslimic Association or something of that sort. And I thought he was great. He distanced himself from the radical elements in the Muslim world, and he made a distinction between the attitude of the Canadian Muslims and these some of the extremist Muslims. And I thought he was quite good. And I don't think all Muslims are radical. You know,
no, nobody's saying they are. The question is, when do the ones that aren't radical going to take to the streets and, mm-hmm. and make that clear to everybody? You know, we had Tariq Fateh, who was a founder of one of the moderate Islamic groups, who resigned recently because he was afraid of for his family and afraid for himself.
Oh, yeah. Well, to be sure, you know, the people living in Canada, once people have been living in a secular society like Canada, they don't have the same attitudes as people who living in some of these countries. And this fella made a point of saying that a lot of them were not educated, that they were very poor, and that they were easily exploited, you know. So I don't know. It's a serious problem. And somehow or other, the more moderates are going to have to reach over to the extremists. I mean, he said he was putting out a lot of emails. Well, you know, you've got to put out a lot more emails to get things moving. You know, to get the love, the harmony.
Well, we believe that the moderates outweigh the radicals, but it really is time for every person to be counted, I think, and I think that's what we're all looking for. But we're always also looking for everybody in this country.
Yeah.
Christian, Jew, Muslim, to accept liberalism and pluralism,
mm-hmm.
and keep their personal faiths within their personal lives, and understand that that is the great glory of any Western liberal society. Peter, thanks very much.
Okay, Canada is a great country. That's all I can tell you.
Thank you, Peter.
Right. Bye.
We're very privileged to be joined right now by Deepak Oprai. He's the Member of Parliament for Calgary East and the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Foreign Affairs for Asia and the Pacific. Mr. Oprai, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
My pleasure, Mr. Weissman. It's a great pleasure to talk to your listeners.
You have a couple of hot files in your ministry right now. You've got Afghanistan, you've got Darfur, and I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about each one. Let me start with something that's been bothering me about Darfur. There was a rally this weekend in Toronto, and I've called it policy by celebrity. All of a sudden, we had Senator Dallaire, who before he was a senator, was viciously critical of the Liberal government, which did nothing. I mean, we, the Institute of Public Affairs, would do demonstrations just calling on the government to call Darfur a genocide. They wouldn't even do that. Then he was appointed to the Senate, and he said, well, you know, it's fine. We don't need to do anything because the white man, quote, shouldn't go to Africa. And now he's criticizing the Conservative government for not doing anything, which he was criticizing before. How does this policy by celebrity, this has got to make you crazy.
Well, that is true, but Senator Dallaire's flip-flop is his flip-flop. Remember, he's a liberal senator. But in reference to the fact...
But he's more than that. He's almost an iconoclastic figure in Canada.
Well, let me just say this. Canada is very heavily engaged in Africa and in Darfur. In July, I went to Brussels at the donors conference, and I made a very strong statement over there to the government of Sudan that it was not acceptable and that we wanted a UN force in Darfur, and we were even willing to put the money.
Mr. Oprai, I'm sorry to interrupt. We've got to take a break, but I want to come back and discuss this issue of the UN force versus the African Union force. We'll be right back.
All right.
And tonight and tomorrow night, we'll be looking at the agenda facing the United Nations General Assembly, and the way the General Assembly works is enough to make everybody angry and everybody a little crazy. The mendacity and hypocrisy in there is unbelievable, and so often it's reflected back home. And we're privileged tonight to be talking to Deepak Oprai, who's Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. His particular dossier is Asia and the Pacific. And Mr. Oprai, we were talking before the break. You've got two hot-button issues, Darfur and Afghanistan, and we're talking about the hypocrisy of some liberals on Darfur when they wouldn't act and now are sort of retroactively trying to mirror their inaction on a conservative government that's actually brought out a very bold vision for this country. And I was asking you whether particularly Senator Dallaire's comments aren't maddening because he didn't want any involvement. as of last year when he became a senator.
That's true. And, well, the senator's position is the senator's position. But our position is very clear. We have told the government of Sudan that we would like a transition to the UN force. That is because the African Union forces themselves have stated that they can't do the job. Now, Canada has spent, since 2004, $320 million in support of the African Union forces and humanitarian and diplomatic support. So we are a very heavy partner in that region. But now we want the transition to the UN forces because we believe that the UN force will be able to bring peace in that region and stop the fighting that is taking place, especially attacks on civilians and the internally displaced persons.
Mr. Obere, given that the Sudan, we know that the problem in Darfur is not a religious problem. We have the problem of Arab Muslims killing African Muslims. And the Janjaweed is basically carrying out a war of racial genocide. Given the refusal of the Sudanese government to even recognize that aspect of the problem, how much hope can we hold out that this session of the United Nations will be able to put together a concerted international effort?
Well, we both Canada and its other partners like Britain are putting tremendous amount of pressure on the government of Sudan to accept this. As much so that the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Peter McKay, just called the Sudanese Foreign Minister to tell him to accept the UN force. Peter McKay is already in United Nations. And he will be in dialogue with the other members as well as Britain and everybody else to see what we can do to force international pressure on Sudan. But one of the things that we need to know, and while I was in Africa about 3 weeks ago, in all my talks with the African government, I was also pressuring the African government to tell the government of Sudan to accept a UN transition force. So the pressure is mounting from all sides, and I don't know and I don't think that the government of Sudan will continue on this course. I think somewhere down the line, the government of Sudan is going to have to accept that. Matter of fact, the rebel group with which they signed the agreement has also called for the UN forces to come in there.
Mr. Obere, stay with us through one caller. Tawab is on the line.
Sure.
Tawab, good evening. Tawab, our technical gremlins are killing our callers tonight. I apologize. Tawab?
Yes.
Tawab, are you there?
Are you hearing me?
Yes, now I hear you. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Okay, you're on the line, and Mr. Deepak Oprah is on the line.
I was just listening to you on my way home from work and about these Muslim moderates and these extremists. You know, I'm originally from Afghanistan, and I lived this war that we had against the Soviet Union. And to a certain extent, for these Muslim extremists, these radical groups that do exist, some of the Western world got to have some sort of responsibility for creating and funding these extremists, because I saw it in Afghanistan. We had seven political parties. Out of seven, there was four of them, the extremists.
That were religious-based.
Yes.
I think, you know, you anticipated a question I was going to put to Mr. Obere, which we'll get to after the break, but I think it's important to remember that, yes, they were funded by the West, but at that time, when they were fighting off the Soviet Union, they weren't, there was no concept that the West was the enemy or anybody was the enemy. They were fighting off an aggressive invasion of their country by the Soviet Union. And we'll get right back to this, if you could just stay on the line right after this short break.
All right.
We'll be back with Deepak Oprah, and we're going to be discussing Afghanistan. And
right.
Tawab, please stay on the line, and we'll continue this discussion.
All right.
Montreal, we're back, and tonight and tomorrow night we'll be looking at the foreign affairs agenda. We're privileged to have with us Deepak Oprah, Parliamentary Secretary, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, responsible for Asia and the Pacific. We're talking about Afghanistan, and Tawab is on the line with us. Tawab, are you still there?
Yes.
You know, this is something that bothers me in the way Canadians think, and the way a lot of the soft left and the politically correct thing. Yes, the Mujahideen, the religious warriors, were funded by the West. Yes, they were warriors against a nation invading them.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not a justification to say, well, because they were allies with us then, and they turned against the West, that we should somehow lie down and play dead and say, well, gee, since we helped them then, we've got no right to go and clobber them now. Well, right now, they're killing people.
Right now, they want
Islamic hegemony over the world.
That's correct. But what happens is these were the soldiers that were fighting the Soviet Union, and they think the job is not finished. So they think that's their right. So once the Soviet collapses, once the communist regime is no longer there, so they are the one who's supposed to govern the country.
You know, Tawab, what I wonder? I wonder how much of them were holy warriors, in quotations, against any non-Islamic intervention, and how many became that only after they saw that they could stop the Soviet Union and they could continue another movement.
The holy warriors, they stopped fighting once the Soviet Union starts to leave the country.
But Tawab, you were...
The leadership is... They were the most corrupted people out there.
But Tawab, you remember
that
the most successful leader against the Soviets
was
Ahmed Khan Musa, and he was pro-West, and he was anti-clerical, and he was secular, and Bin Laden killed him. And he had the strongest army, and he had the strongest...
Ahmad Shah Massoud, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, Massoud. Yeah, but if you look at the whole scenario and all these things that happened before the 9/11, you know, he was killed because he was too close to the Soviets. And...
He wasn't close to the Soviet. He was close to America.
He wasn't.
Yes, he was.
He was killed
by Bin Laden's operatives because he was close to America. He was the head of the Northern Alliance.
The West was so scared that he was too tight. He was very close. And if you remember, after the 9/11, we had Soviet army right in Afghanistan.
Not after 9/11.
Yes, it did. They had their bases. They did open their bases in Kabul. They had their hospitals. But after a few days, they all left and they went back.
They had facilities, but not army.
Yes, they did. They did land armies.
They didn't land armies. They landed facilities. Tawab, we thank you for your call. Let me just turn back to Mr. Obrey. Right. Mr. Obrey, this is a big problem for Canadians to understand, that the mission in Afghanistan is peacemaking. It's to give the government time to get their democratic constructs in place. And so much is always referred back in time rather than looking forward. As General Lewis Mackenzie once said, if there were beam counters at D-Day, we'd never have liberated Europe. This is the big challenge for the government today, is it not? To make Canadians see with the eyes of those who have compassion for countries like Afghanistan, and we have a responsibility to help countries like this.
Absolutely, and I would like to bring the attention to September 11th. September 11th happened, which shook the Western world, you know, and it originated from Afghanistan. We had ignored Afghanistan for such a long time, but Afghanistan had gone down the road of a failed state, for no matter what you want to say. Now, we know now that failed states pose a threat and danger to us, and it is better for us to do that. And that's what we did with Afghanistan. We went over there. I was in Berlin with donors' conference. We pledged $40 billion, 40 countries, to rebuild Afghanistan. And yes, all efforts are going there now being to rebuild Afghanistan. But you cannot have rebuilding efforts going on if there is no security. Now, look, the four Canadians that died, unfortunately, yesterday, were handing out goods to the children.
Candy.
They were not fighting, you know. I mean, so this is what is what we are facing as a danger. When somebody says, oh, our soldiers are dying because we are going after the Taliban, what happened yesterday is a clear example that we need to provide security so the construction carries on. If we don't, there won't be a rehabilitation of Afghanistan. And if there's not going to be a rehabilitation of Afghanistan, it's going to remain a failed state posing danger to everybody.
And it's not just about Canada not cutting and running, as the Prime Minister very boldly said. It's also about the responsibility of G8 countries to help nations like Afghanistan get reestablished.
Well,
we can't just be taking from the third world all the time.
No, and remember, we are in Afghanistan under the UN banner.
Yes, we are.
The UN has asked us to be there, and we are with NATO. There are 36 countries in that part of the world that is working to provide peace so reconstruction can carry on. And other countries in the world are pouring money in. Japan is pouring, India is pouring, everybody's pouring money in there.
You know, the ironic thing about the whole Afghanistan debate, and particularly my favorite target, Jumpin' Jack Flash Layton, as I call him, Adam Radwanski asked this weekend, how shallow is this man? Well, you know, my mind, he's pretty shallow. When people forget in this country that those who don't like the Kandahar mission, those who would say we should be in Afghanistan, but Kandahar's too dangerous, we don't have the means. The reason, people forget that the reason we got the Kandahar mission was because all the other missions had been taken and because the last Liberal government was dithering about its commitment, so there was only one mission left, and that was Kandahar.
And that is right. The Liberals were dithering. Remember, Liberals are the ones that sent her to Kandahar. So it is like it's so ironic that they stand up in the House and asking us, we want an exit strategy, we want all this. You know, when
Churchill didn't have an exit strategy. Churchill's exit strategy was victory in spite of all terror, victory at all costs.
And, you know, our soldiers have died in Afghanistan. We must remember them, and we must remember their sacrifice. And I can tell you, as my Prime Minister said, we aren't running away.
Deepak Obray, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for the bold vision of this new government.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Montreal, we'll be right back. As I said at the start of the hour, we'll be examining today, tomorrow night, the United Nations, the world issues that affect us, the hypocrisy that affects us, come emanating from that place. And before I introduce our next guest, I want to tell you, sitting here in this studio and right now watching the monitor of Ahmadinejad, the Iranian dictator, speaking at the UN, he has the audacity to have used words that justice has been a victim of force and aggression. It's very hard to sit in this studio and listen to this obscenity, dirtying the halls of the United Nations, outside of whose building, engraved in stone, are the words of Isaiah, that nation shall not make war upon nation anymore. And this obscenity is speaking inside. Nani Darwish from Los Angeles, many of you seen her often on CNN, one of the gutsiest ladies and one of the top specialists in radical Islam. Nani, you didn't expect me to call you tonight, but I couldn't sit here in this studio and watch this guy without somebody getting my blood pressure down. I got to share this with somebody. This is unbelievable speech. The audacity of this guy.
Yeah,
you're watching it now as well, I know.
It's unbelievable. What I have to start saying is that we, the West, if you want more of us to speak out, more moderates to speak out, you have to bring us up and put radicals down. We cannot continue treating radical Islam equal to the people who want to change it. We are trying to doing our best and standing up, and few of us are even being threatened, and we allow the radicals to put the agenda. We have to take it away from them. The West has to understand that enough is enough. Political correctness has to end. They are taking advantage of our open system.
Well, you know, you're quite right, and we not only have to make common cause with brave, courageous, moderate Muslims such as yourself, but we have to bring the message out into the general community. And we're going to be doing that at an institute conference in October, and Nani Darwish will be in Montreal, and we'll be announcing that later on. It is just, you're watching this. I'm getting the feed, Nani, as we're speaking. Ahmadinejad is saying that some countries consider themselves masters and builders of the world, while others, such as his own, are suffering under oppression and aggression. This is the man whose prosecutor general last month killed student leader Akbar Mohammadi, partially by gluing his mouth closed. This is the man who calls for the extermination of the Jews. This is the man who calls for the extermination of Israel and the establishment of a caliphate. And he is now pleading at the United Nations that he's suffering under oppression and aggression. It's astounding stuff.
Yeah, well, leaders of the Arab world and the Muslim world are constantly encouraging the people to be in constant feeling of victimhood. And that's how they win. That's how they stay in power. So the more he incites people to feel...
To make them feel like victims and also to demonize everybody else.
Blame everybody else. Blame the West and never point at yourself. Never self-analyze. Never talk about your responsibility towards your own culture. Never blame maybe or doubt. Maybe I did something wrong. And that is exactly opposite to Western culture that is involved heavily in self-criticism and Western guilt. And put the two together and you have a World War III. We have to start standing up to this ridiculous kind of speech. It's the Muslim world is in constant state of being offended.
Well, Nani Darwish, with brave voices like yours, we will stand with you and we will see you in October in Montreal. Thank you very much and we'll talk to you later in the week.
Thanks
for taking this call. My thanks to Nick Mays, Master Control. We're out of here till tomorrow.